KPTZ now joins the Board of County Commissioners' weekly meeting in progress for this week's public health updates, held as a virtual meeting during the pandemic. Jefferson County Public Health Officer Dr. Allison Berry and Department of Emergency Management Director Willie Bentz will now brief our commissioners and you, our KPTZ listeners.
We can take this moment to say that next week is a holiday, but we're having our session on Tuesday next week. Is that right? So this will, we already talked to KPTZ and this weekly update will be on Tuesday next week.
Right, the 22nd.
There's Dr. Berry.
Good morning, Dr. Berry. Welcome. Welcome to Valentine's Day. Happy Valentine's Day.
Good morning. Happy Valentine's Day, everyone. And thank you, everyone, for your patience last week with my guest. She was very patient, I would say, as well with the 45-minute meeting. So thank you for making space for that. So COVID-19 updates. We are seeing improvements nationwide in COVID-19 case rates, hospitalizations. We are also starting to see the very beginning of a downturn in deaths nationwide as well. But we are still seeing just under 2,500 Americans die every day due to COVID-19. So we are certainly at the peak of deaths that we've seen in this country. But we are at least now starting to see them turn down. What we're seeing in the national trends is different parts of the country hit their peaks earlier or later. And so those who hit their peaks earlier are seeing their cases come down earlier. Those who hit their peaks later are seeing their cases come down later. And so in Washington state, we are one of the later groups. We got our peak later than much of the large northeastern cities did. So, but we are starting to see our cases come down as well. We have seen roughly a 30% decrease in cases in the last week in Washington state, and that's very hopeful. For the first time, we have seen, we're seeing decreases both on the east side of the mountains and on the west side of the mountains. And so that's all very promising. We are, of course, still at very high rates of transmission. Our current 2-week case rate in the state is 2,500 cases per 100,000, so still very, very high, about 4 times the height of any previous peak of COVID-19 infections. In Jefferson County, we are starting to see our cases trend down as well. So our current total number of COVID-19 cases is 2,874. Our case rate is down to 743 per 100,000, so a significant drop from last week, and with a 21% positivity. We have 5 of our citizens currently hospitalized for COVID-19, and we have had 26 deaths. That is 1 new death since last Friday. This was a person in their 90s who was unvaccinated. In Clallam County, case rates are also coming down. Our current case rate is 1,224 as of Friday. I haven't gotten the updated numbers yet, but we are certainly significantly down from our peak, which is about 2,400 cases per 100,000. Kitsap's still quite high. Their case rate is actually higher than both of ours at this point. Their current case rate is 2,213 per 100,000. So, looking at our numbers, we are very much moving in the right direction, but we still have very high rates of transmission. We do anticipate that these case rates will continue to decrease over February and March. However, that is not predestined. That is not guaranteed to happen if we change our other mitigation measures. So all of that modeling of cases coming down really smoothly and rapidly through February and March are based on our current mitigation measures. And so one of the things that we have to caution against is there is a very natural human tendency when things get a little better, especially when you've gotten used to them being really bad, to say, great, we're through it, it's over. And I really want to caution all of our population against that. We do anticipate that better days are ahead of us, and they are very soon. We do think that we're going to be in a much better place by about mid-March, an even better place by April. But if we loosen up our mitigation measures right now, we could see a prolonging of this surge and a prolonging of all of the pains that come with a significant COVID-19 surge. So I really want to encourage everybody to hang on a little longer. There is light at the end of the tunnel, and it's closer than it has ever been. We are very likely to be able to remove many mitigation measures in March or April. So we're going to be lifting the proof of vaccination order in March, most likely, unless we see our cases drop significantly even before that. And likely we will see a lifting of mask mandates this spring as well. The exact timing of that is still being determined at the local and state level. And we can talk some more about the details around that. But really what we're working on is trying to set a safe case threshold when it is reasonable to move from mask mandates to mask recommendations. And I anticipate that that safer case threshold will likely be end of March, early April. So very soon that we could see that coming to pass. What would be very dangerous is to do it right now while our cases are still very high. That would likely lead to a prolonging of the surge, if not a subsequent peak. And we don't want to do that. We're almost to the end. Just a couple other updates. There've been a couple more things happened since the last time we came together. We were talking a bit about pediatric vaccinations for kids under five. The Pfizer team went ahead and actually pulled their data from FDA review. So they are not moving forward with applying for that vaccination approval at this point for kids under five. The primary reason for that is they did not see enough efficacy in the kids under five. Pfizer made the decision to try for a very low dose of the vaccine in this age range to try to reduce side effects. Unfortunately, I think that decision to move to a very low dose had the unintended consequence of reducing immunogenicity. So they weren't able to get the kind of immune response they needed from that very, very low dose. And so they are going to go forward with trials of three doses for this age population to see if they get a significant enough immune response. If they don't, it won't go forward. And that has, it's hard to remember because we've had so much success with vaccines. But in the early days when we were talking about vaccines, we expected some of them to not be effective. And this may be one of the first times that that happens, that the data just don't support moving forward because it's not effective enough at the current dose. As a parent of a person under five, I want to share some empathy with all of the parents who have been waiting for that vaccine news. It's very painful to realize that we can't protect the youngest among us who do have the highest rate of hospitalization among children. Know that everyone is still working very hard to get to that point. There are trials ongoing for a three-dose series of the Pfizer vaccine. There are also trials ongoing for the Moderna vaccine that are looking somewhat more promising for this age group. And we would likely see results of that later this spring, early summer. So with that, I am happy to take any questions.
You used a new word for me. I was wondering if you could define it a little bit more.
Absolutely.
Immunogenicity, is that what you said?
Oh, yeah, fair. Valid. Thank you for calling me out on using Scrabble words. So immunogenicity is the ability to mount an immune response in response to some stimuli. When we use vaccines, what they always try to do is use the smallest dose, the smallest amount of virus particle or other factors to mount the proper immune response. Everyone's always trying to make it as low side effect as possible, because as we know, even mild side effects can pose a burden to people getting vaccinated. You know, feeling like you have the flu for a day after is one of the reasons why some people say they didn't get vaccinated. And so in an attempt to make this lower side effect, that very, very low dose likely wasn't enough to mount an immune response. There are other trials ongoing with a larger dose, but we don't have the data on that.
Great, thank you. And I saw lots of questions from KPTZ, so I'll defer until after that.
I have one quick one, Dr. Berry. You mentioned you get an idea of when the governor might consider rescinding the masking order. I assume that's not going to be 100% across the board, right? I mean, can we still expect mask requirements in things like congregate care settings? Are there places that will continue, or is it going to be just a free for all?
Good clarification. So I think Important to note that whenever this change happens, and we don't know yet, but we actually likely will have a date by the end of this week, is that we will be moving from requirements in public indoor settings to recommendations in public indoor settings. So things like grocery stores, workplaces, things like that. There will continue to be high risk settings where masks are required. So that's things like healthcare settings, long-term care facilities, places where people are interacting with sick patients. So that also includes ambulance rigs. So anytime that we're dealing with the very vulnerable, they're very likely to be masking requirements maintained in those spaces. And I want to acknowledge that there is a lot of stress around masks in every direction right now. I hear from folks who really want them gone right now. I hear from other folks who are okay hanging on a little bit, but they just need to know that the mandates will end at some point. And then I hear from other folks who are very scared about the removal of mask mandates. And I think that is a valid position to speak to as well. When we remove mask mandates, more people will go unmasked, even if we clearly recommend it. And so for the vulnerable, for those who are can't mount immune responses to their vaccines, this is a stressful time to hear that we might take this protection away. Please know that we consider these decisions very carefully. There have been multiple meetings on this topic, and there will be more this week of all of the health officers getting together so that we can come to some consensus on what a safer case rate looks like that we can present to the governor. The final decision on the state mandate is up to the governor, but we do advise him on these kind of things. And we do have a local mandate as well for Clallam and Jefferson counties. My preference is to move with the state. I think it will be very hard to maintain a local mask mandate alone if we are the only county left doing it, which is part of why it's so important that when the governor picks a case threshold, that we be a part of making sure that that's a safe case threshold. Because what we want to do is wait until the point where the probability that someone has COVID in the grocery store with you is actually pretty low, so that it is safer to go there, even if other people are unmasking. And of course, recall the number one thing that you can do to protect yourself from severe illness and death is to get vaccinated and get that booster. That's really important. And to wear a high quality mask yourself. So KN95, KF94, or an N95 when you go out into those spaces. Many people in our community, I believe, will continue to wear masks. And especially if you are in a high risk group, I strongly encourage you to continue to do so. When you see me out in Jefferson County in indoor spaces, I will also be in one.
I think that's a really important thing to reiterate. It's just people have the choice to continue wearing a mask. It's not like the mandate being removed is like a rule that they take off their mask. It's like you can still, as an individual citizen, continue masking if that's what makes you feel safe. And I've had a number of individual conversations with elders in my life who, you know, are not sure they'll ever feel safe not wearing a mask. And that's just a byproduct of the times we've just lived through together. So I don't have any questions to add. I did notice that there were a number of questions that we didn't get to last week, it looked like. So I would defer to the list of questions from our KPTZ community of listeners.
So yes, we have quite a few questions, and I will try to get through this list. And if we don't get to some, then we'll move them to next week and keep moving forward that way. So one question says, it appears that COVID in some form will be with us indefinitely. How soon will we see the Pfizer treatment medication in Jefferson County? Do you foresee that these treatment medications will eventually become over the counter? So we are starting to see increased availability of therapeutics. So the medicines to treat COVID-19 in our community, those were in critical short supply over the last several months as the entire country experienced a massive wave at the same time. Now that many very populous parts of our country are seeing their case rates come down, that is freeing up therapeutics to come to us. So we are seeing increased availability of what's called citrovimab. It's the IV monoclonal antibody that still works against Omicron. We have increased availability of that. We have a little bit of increased availability of Paxlovid. We actually got 60 doses into our community. And I do share that number so people understand the scale of what we're working with. It's not that much, but it is starting we're starting to see a little bit more come in. We also have one called molnupiravir, which is an antiviral, which is less effective than Paxlovid, but is another option if the other two are not available to you. At this point, because we still have very short supplies, these are still prioritized to the highest risk among us. So those who are over 65, who have underlying conditions, if you are unvaccinated or just unboosted, so if you haven't gotten your booster yet, and you fall into one of those groups, it's important to contact your doctor right away if you test positive for COVID-19 so that you can access one of these treatments. They are all prescription only. There are some reasons for that. They have some interactions with medications. There are some risks of some significant side effects that you have to talk to your doctor about. All of these work better the faster you get them. So that's part of why it's so important if you get sick to get tested right away, because Paxlovid in particular has to be started within 5 days of symptom onset. And it's most effective if it started within 3 days of symptom onset. So if you wait a while to get tested, then you could actually end up out of the window where that medication would be effective for you. So do contact your doctor if you're in a high-risk group, especially if you're unvaccinated or unboosted, so they can help you access these treatments that we're starting to have more availability of. I should be clear, we still don't have anywhere near the Paxlovid supply that we want to see. We do anticipate that that will increase in the coming months. And remember, the number one thing you can do to reduce your risk of severe COVID-19 infection is to get that booster. Actually, we are not seeing hospitalization and death of boosted folks, with the very rare exception of those who have immune systems that can't respond to their virus. And so get that booster. And then if you are in a high risk group, even if you did all those things, you got your booster and you don't have a functioning immune system, do still contact your doctor because you would qualify for one of those medications in that group. The next question is it safe for me to eat out in restaurants now since I'm fully vaccinated and boosted? I have been avoiding it because I don't want to get the virus, even if it's mild. And so I would say for all of us, our definition of safe can be a little bit variable. And I think it depends a lot on you. Eating indoors, unmasked with other people does increase your risk of contracting COVID-19, even if all of those people are vaccinated. Now, certainly it's much safer if all of those people are vaccinated, but it's not 100% safe. And so if you are in a group who really, really doesn't want to get COVID, either because you would get very sick or because someone in your home would get very sick, I would recommend waiting until our cases are at a lower case threshold, so lower than that 200 cases per 100,000 rate to eat indoors, and encourage eating outdoors. There's some very creative outdoor seating that's still warm. You can also, of course, participate in take-home meals. I know that's my mom right now doesn't eat indoors. And so when we want to support our local restaurants, we get some takeout and we have a lovely meal at home. But we are going to get there. It's getting a lot better. Once those case rates get down to below 200 cases per 100,000, be a lot safer. It has now exceeded 4 months since receiving my COVID shot booster. I am concerned that the effectiveness may be diminishing. Is there a reason to get a fourth shot? And we actually got a couple questions about fourth shots. So if you are healthy, if you have a functioning immune system, there is no indication at this time for the need for a fourth shot. We are still seeing very good efficacy of the boosters, preventing, of course, the most important things, hospitalization, death, severe disease, and good efficacy at preventing symptomatic infection as a whole, but it's not 100%. It is still possible to get a breakthrough, but we're not seeing a need for a fourth dose at this time, with the exception of those who are immunosuppressed. So if you are on immunosuppressing medications, if you have active cancer, or if you have a genetic immunodeficiency, you are someone who does qualify for a fourth dose, and we recommend you get that fourth dose now 3 months after your booster dose. That used to be 5 months, and that changed. It's actually a shorter window now. So if it's been 3 months since your booster and you're in that group, we strongly recommend you go ahead and get your fourth dose. The vaccines are widely available and folks will help you get your fourth dose. All you have to do is tell them that you're immunocompromised. This person says, my daughter was vaccinated but not boosted and caught COVID and had a mild case. She used an at-home test and took a week or so off of work. Her boyfriend caught it too. Do the stats on COVID cases capture these sort of infections? Is there a chance that we are undercounting? It depends. So if your daughter called Jefferson County Public Health, then yes, we would capture that case. So at-home cases that are reported to us are captured in our numbers. But is there a chance that we are undercounting? Absolutely, we are undercounting. Because most at-home tests are never reported to us. So most of those cases won't be in our case numbers. And many people aren't getting tested. So they're just sick. They don't get tested. They don't tell anybody. And so when we see right now, our percent positivity is 21%. That is very high. That suggests that there are a lot of cases out there that we don't know about. But what we do follow is the trends. So we've used the same definition this whole time. And so when we see cases rise and then fall, it still is a measure of community prevalence, even though it's an imperfect measure. But it's a good reminder that you can call us if you're positive, and we will add you to our numbers. The next question was another question about treatment. So they're starting to become available. They're not widely available, but we are seeing increased availability. So do call if you're in a high-risk group. One question asked, do you have a prediction on when Jefferson Healthcare will start elective surgeries and procedures again? Yes. So in Washington state, elective procedures were put on hold statewide because of the critical shortage of ICU beds statewide. And so that applied to Jefferson County as well. That is being lifted February 18th. So very soon. And given the current status of staffing at Jefferson Healthcare, I anticipate that elective surgeries will start shortly thereafter. In a well-ventilated hospital-grade ventilation system with windows open hall, is it safe for social partner dances to resume for fully vaccinated and boosted individuals? It is difficult to dance masks. Should masks be worn in this setting? Should dancer numbers be limited? And many of our dancers are over 65 and have some other health conditions. Are there special safety concerns for them? And so what I would say is, it sounds like this person is doing a lot of good things. They've got good ventilation, they've got their windows open, but they are aware of the high risk nature of the people who are dancing. If proof of vaccination is required to enter, and masks are required, I think it is very reasonable to bring back partner dancing. One added layer of safety that you could add is requiring a good quality mask. So requiring a KN95, a KF94, and making sure people wear them. So if you see someone nose masking, help them out, tighten their straps, and then get them masked up again. I think it would be very safe in that context to resume partner dancing. In fact, there's a dance hall in the King County area that's doing just exactly that, and they've done really well without any outbreaks, despite really quite high case rates in the King County area over the last couple of months. This one says, we got a couple questions about church services. So some of our local churches closed to indoor services during this recent surge and have been talking about how and when to reopen. Many are considering reopening when we hit that less than 200 cases per 100,000 threshold and wondering how to do so safely. And so key there is, especially with the demographic of Jefferson County, I would recommend a couple additional safety protocols. So requiring masks and high quality masks really does make a big difference in reducing transmission. And consider a lower attendance, so like a 50% capacity for your worship space with windows open, good ventilation. If you do all of those things, I think it's very safe to do services in person. It is also safe to sing if you're wearing a good quality mask. So we had talked a little bit before about singing masks under Delta. Now I would recommend transitioning to more of a KN95 or KF94. I would share that many singers find a KN95 works really well because it stands off of your face. So try it out, see what works for you. Higher quality masks will make a big difference. And then for now, until our case rates are in a safer range, I would recommend against kind of indoor meals related to these and save that until we're in a safer case range. This person asked, they said they have a Binax Now kit that shows an expiration date of January 2022. Is there a little leeway on that expiration date? So for many of the Binex Now kits, there actually is. So many of them were printed with a 3-month expiration date. We've now had enough testing to study them and see their efficacy. And so the FDA has approved their use for 12 months after their manufacture date. So if you look at your Binex Now kit, you'll see the expiration date, and a couple lines below it, you'll see the manufacture date. If you stretch it out 12 months past that manufacture date, you should still be very much in a safe range to use it. Of course, double check. Make sure the control line lights up. So there's a test and a control line. If your control line doesn't turn positive, it's not a good test. And we are seeing increased availability of tests now. So if you are in doubt that your test is expired, do go ahead and get another one. We do have some if you are exposed or symptomatic at Jefferson Public Health. And there's also, of course, testing through Jefferson Healthcare. We've also gotten some of our tests down to South County at the fire stations as well. So there are options to get you tested if you're worried yours is expired. This person also asked if you could donate your home test to other groups. And I would say at this point, no. When we're dealing with medical devices, we are very, very cautious about safety. So I would say probably keep them for yourself, though I know there's definitely some trading going on. I know a lot of moms of young kids that it's become like currency to have a Binex Now test at home. I think that's very reasonable, but large distributions to organizations we can't do with medical devices at this point, unless they come directly through Jefferson Public Health. And then this next question was about immunity from prior infection, or what you often hear termed natural immunity. And so this is kind of a longer question, but what I would say is we are continuing to study immunity from prior infection and immunity from vaccination. And I do think that it has been problematic that there has been a bit of a kind of schism here and people kind of pick their sides. And in truth, as a community, we want to see more immunity in the entirety of the community. And there is some immunity that comes from prior infection. There is also immunity that comes from vaccination. What we know so far is that immunity from prior infection alone is not good enough for Omicron. You really do need to go on and get vaccinated beyond that. But if you have immunity from prior infection and you get vaccinated, that dramatically reduces your risk of contracting the Omicron infection. I think it's gotten caught up in this politics of the virus that we wish wasn't there. We do know that you get some immunity from prior infection, but the best thing to do is to boost that immunity by getting vaccinated as well, because you don't want to do it again. And you certainly don't want to be responsible for contracting the infection and giving it to someone else. I also have heard some folks who are trying to as a part of this conversation, think that maybe they should just go get COVID because it'll be the best possible immunity. And that's not true. We certainly don't have any evidence that immunity from prior infection is somehow superior to immunity from vaccination. And there's a lot of unintended consequences there. If you get immunity from infection alone, there's the possibility you get severely ill and die. And there's also the very likely possibility that you give it to other people before you realize that you have it. So that's why we don't do that. We have a safe alternative to that, and it's getting vaccinated. But if you have gotten COVID and you have survived it, we are so glad you are still with us. Please also get vaccinated so that we can make sure that this never happens to you again. We do see that immunity from a single infection or a single dose of the vaccine fades. That's why there are boosters. And so that's why it's so important to get vaccinated after you recover. This person, then we started to, a couple of our questions started to lean into some of the misinformation sphere. So this person has heard that young male children are hospitalized from myocarditis from the vaccine more often than from the virus. And that's simply not true. So just to reiterate some of the data around myocarditis in particular. Myocarditis is a very rare possible side effect of the vaccine. It is most commonly seen in young men. Myocarditis is also a possible side effect of COVID-19 itself. It is also seen more commonly in young men in that group. So in one study of athletes who had contracted COVID-19, so college level basketball player athletes, they found that 2.4% of them had clinically significant myocarditis after their COVID-19 infection. That is about 6 times the rate that we have even seen in young men from the vaccine in myocarditis alone. So We also see that myocarditis from COVID-19 is much, much more severe than myocarditis from the vaccine. In most cases, myocarditis from the vaccine is either asymptomatic and only picked up on an MRI, or very mild, so just causing chest pain that resolves spontaneously. In very, very rare instances, it can cause severe symptoms. And so far, all of those that we have followed have resolved spontaneously, and they have returned to normal function thereafter. That is very different than the myocarditis we see from COVID-19 that often leads to long-term disability and death, even of young people. So, and that's just the myocarditis part. There's all these other things that COVID-19 can do and lead to pneumonia, hospitalization from that, clots, long COVID, lots of bad things that you don't wanna do. So that's why we recommend the vaccine for kids. It's why we recommend the vaccine even for young male kids, because it is safer than getting COVID. This person asked, why is the USA an outlier globally for suggesting boosters for children? And I would say we're not as much of an outlier as you might think. So Germany, Israel, the UK, and France all recommend boosters for children. Part of why we are at the point where we are recommending boosters for children is because our vaccine distribution system is ahead of much of the rest of the world. So our kids were vaccinated before many other kids in the rest of the world had access to any vaccines at all. And so now they are many months out, which is the time when a booster would become needed. I think you will see in much of the EU an increased uptake of boosters as they get 4, 5, 6 months out from their primary series. The biggest reason for the difference between countries is not any different understanding of safety. We all have the same data. It is a difference in access to vaccine and when we had that access. And so the timing of when we roll out our vaccines will be slightly different in much of the industrialized world. Of course, there are still huge vaccine inequities. Much of the world does not have access to the kind of vaccine that we do. And a lot of work needs to be done on that worldwide for the sake of the people in those countries and for the sake of all of us who could get exposed to subsequent variants. This person says, I have family in other parts of the country whose children do not mask in school, yet they say there is no transmission at their schools. Is there data that compares public K-12 schools that mask versus mask-free and their different transmission rates? So I would say very unlikely that there's any part of the country where there is no masking in schools and there is also no transmission. Very likely those family members might just not know about it, but that actually has been studied. So Arizona lifted their masking requirements and in their schools let every school kind of decide for themselves whether or not they were gonna wear masks. So it actually created, unfortunately, a pretty good experiment of the efficacy of masking in schools. So throughout Maricopa and Pima County of Arizona, there was a scatter pattern of masking in schools. And so comparing over 1,000 schools, we found that those who were unmasked were 3.5 times as likely to have large scale outbreaks than the schools that had masking requirements. So it does make a huge difference. It's a very important intervention at reducing transmission in schools. I do think there is a day where mask requirements can come off in schools, and that is when we have low rates of community transmission, so that the probability of getting into those spaces is lower. As we get closer and closer to that date, it's going to be really important that as many of our kids as possible get vaccinated against COVID-19. Our vaccination rates in kids are very low in this county. It's the lowest rate of all of the groups in our county. And so I am worried that if we don't increase that vaccination rate, we will see much more transmission in our schools when we lift mask mandates. And that leads to a lot of unnecessary disruption of kids' lives. So I really encourage everyone to get their kids vaccinated as soon as possible. Then we got, it sounds like maybe another person who's been spending some time in the misinformation sphere of the internet had a lot of questions about the Pfizer vaccine trials. So there is a common piece of misinformation that you'll see circulated on the internet from one of the first Pfizer vaccine trials, suggesting that more people died in the vaccinated group than in the unvaccinated group. Important to remember that this is one of the first trials. We've had a ton of subsequent data on the efficacy of the Pfizer vaccine, but what they found was in the vaccinated group, 15 people died And in the unvaccinated group, 14 people died. But I think it's important to remember this was all-cause mortality, not COVID-19 mortality. So for the most extreme example, getting vaccinated against COVID-19 does not prevent you from having a car accident. And so in those early trials, especially since they were vaccinating very, very elderly people, some of them were going to die generally. And the fact that the vaccine didn't prevent death from all other causes in life is expected. And that those numbers are roughly the same between those two groups actually shows that they did a good job of getting comparable groups. When you actually look at the COVID-19 mortality, that was 97% reduced between the vaccinated and the unvaccinated group. But it's one of those challenges. We do try really hard to have our data publicly available so people can see it, but it does make it open to misinterpretation. Some people not understanding the data and some people using it to twist it and try to confuse people. This person asked if there have been any valid concerns raised about the Pfizer clinical trial about poor design or data falsification. And the answer is no, actually. Those trials have been very, very heavily scrutinized. We've not seen anything like that. They were very high quality trials. And we also have the subsequent data from the millions of people who have gotten their COVID-19 vaccines that we continue to monitor. So remember, we have four phases of trials. Phase one is the initial safety. Phase two is initial efficacy. Phase three is the randomized control trials that you think of when you think of trials. And phase four is that in this country, we always monitor vaccines. We are always monitoring for safety. And so we have even more data points on the efficacy and safety of these vaccines compared to any vaccine that's ever come before. Okay, a couple other things. We also got a question about if there have been any peer-reviewed ivermectin studies conducted. And if so, how many and what were their results? So yes, actually, we have been studying ivermectin. Ivermectin was an initial medication that we were hoping might be effective against COVID-19. There are a lot of folks looking at treatment possibilities for COVID-19. Unfortunately, all of those trials showed no effect against COVID-19. So that's why we don't use ivermectin anymore for COVID-19, is because we checked. We were interested in it too. It just didn't work out. And so we've moved on to the treatments that we do have that are much more effective. And ivermectin has been used for parasitic infections for some time, and it is effective against parasitic infections. It's just not effective against COVID-19, and we do have better options available. So regardless of your vaccination status, and especially if you're unvaccinated, if you contract COVID-19, please do contact your primary care provider. We have medications that can help you, and it's really important that we get them to you soon, especially if you're unvaccinated. We have two of our citizens in Clallam County right now who are in their 30s who are on ventilators in the ICU. They were both unvaccinated, and that didn't have to happen. Not only because we wish we could have gotten them vaccinated before that happened, but we also wish we could have gotten them treatment quickly. When you delay coming in to get your treatment, we lose a lot of ability to protect you from those severe outcomes. And the Paxlovid works really well. And these folks would have qualified for either that or sotrovimab. All right. This person says that their body does not appear to respond to the COVID vaccine. They've had all three doses, and they haven't seen a significant bump in antibodies in their system. Is it the case that I'm equivalent to an unvaccinated person and need to isolate myself until this pandemic is resolved? Or is it safe for me to be out and about and following masking and distance guidelines? I would say right now, we are trying very hard to figure out an antibody threshold that confers immunity. That's being studied right now. But if for whatever reason medically, someone had cause to check your antibody levels and they've been consistently low, that would suggest that you are likely not mounting a significant enough immune response. So I would definitely talk to your doctor about whether or not it's right for you to get a fourth dose, like the people who are immunosuppressed who have a documented immunodeficiency. Very likely it is, and that could offer you that added protection. What you do lifestyle-wise beyond that, I think the most important thing is just to follow the guidance. So to wear a mask in indoor settings, go to indoor settings where other people are wearing masks. I actually don't recommend permanent self-isolation. I think that is very hard on your mental health. And it's really important to have some forms of socialization. Remember, outdoor gatherings are very safe. You can gather outdoors with other people right now, and that can really be a safe alternative. Or if you want to go indoors, make the group smaller, make them vaccinated, make them masked. If you do all of those things, I think it is safe to gather. And I think it is important for our well-being to be around other people. That actually, I think, is all of our questions. Any other questions from the commissioners at the end of that?
Okay. Kind of an overarching question, just as we, you know, start thinking about the future.
Yeah.
Do you think we will be striving for a zero existence of COVID, or do we expect there to be a base level that we're managing for long-term, and how does that kind of affect how we think about our mitigations and activities in the future?
Thank you. Yes, unfortunately, there is no option of going to zero COVID. There may have been an option in the beginning, and that was part of what we were working on, was we were trying to eradicate it so that we didn't have to keep doing this. But that window has closed. And so now COVID will be with us, and we are not trying to eradicate it, in large part because we can't. We have to find a way to exist safely with it. It's going to be with us. Our goal is to get to the point where COVID does not overwhelm our healthcare system, where it doesn't shut down critical infrastructure, and where we don't see large numbers of unnecessary deaths because of it. And the way that we do that, you know, the number one way, if enough of us were vaccinated and boosted, we wouldn't have to worry about any of this, because we would know that very low probability that any of us were going to get hospitalized and die. But unfortunately, there's such a large proportion of our population that's not vaccinated, that part of why we are still doing all this is to try to prevent transmission and death among that group. But because of the Omicron surge and how many people got COVID, primarily in that unvaccinated group, many of them did pick up some immunity. And that immunity, while it likely will not prevent any subsequent infection, is likely to improve their risk of not getting hospitalized and dying. And so that immunity from prior infection, and of course the safest way to get to immunity by getting vaccinated, all provide us that protection against hospitalization, which helps us not ever overwhelm our hospital system again. So my prediction is that we will see low level transmission of COVID-19 in our community throughout the spring and summer. I anticipate we are likely to see a surge in COVID-19 activity next fall, but I don't think it will be as devastating as prior surges, because so many of us are immune one way or another. And the best way to make sure that it's never devastating again, and that we never have to go back to this, is to get vaccinated. But I don't think we'll return to mandates or with closures or anything like that. I think we are through that time, or will be soon, not quite yet, but we'll be through that time coming later this spring. But very likely we'll get to the point of recommended masking in the fall and winter, when we see flu surges and likely a COVID surge too.
I spent the weekend, I often do this, listening to podcasts about this very issue, and just taking in different experts' perspectives. And I was thinking, it seems like that the message of overwhelming the medical system it seems lost on people a little bit. Like, you know, like, oh, the hospital system's always there. It might take longer. Doctors get paid a lot, you know, whatever. Like, for any number of reasons, that messaging is... doesn't seem to have a big impact on people, which I don't really get, but I've been thinking about all the ripple effects. You know, it's not just like it might take longer to get in to be seen at the ER, but that it's really about like, okay, so how about all of the other medical procedures that aren't happening? Yeah. And when we think about the schools, it's not so much about, how much transmission is happening in school. It's like how many teachers and staff and educators are out because of, they might either be in isolation or just in quarantine because they've been exposed. Mm-hmm. And therefore, do we lose a workforce to be able to keep schools open? And therefore, can people go to work if their kids are home from school? Mm-hmm. Same thing in restaurants. If there's an exposure and the whole staff is out, and or enough of the staff is out that the restaurant can't open, and then none of those workers get paid their wages. Mm-hmm. Like there's just so many other effects that are prevalent in the community, and we saw with Omicron mm-hmm. that I've been putting together all the pieces of like where this actually affects a community like ours. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's I just keep thinking that the mitigations, the sacrifices are so small in order to keep all of those things happening, to keep our service workers able to work, to keep our kids in school, you know, and to keep people from getting sick and to keep people from overwhelming the medical system. But like those are still abstract to people for some reason, even though yeah. we know 2,500 Americans are dying a day. But how about just our wait staff being able to show up for work because it's either a healthy place to be or because they have childcare? Like mm-hmm. we're so vulnerable.
Yeah, I think it's been an opportunity for us to see how connected we are. And also, unfortunately, I think it still somehow remained hidden for a lot of folks that, like, you know, having power to your house is not an accident. There are people who maintain those lines. And when we get a large outbreak among them, it becomes a challenge. And so I think for many folks, they noticed things slowed down. They noticed something wasn't on the shelves. They noticed that their mail didn't show up for a week or so. That happened in part of Clallam County, but they don't know why. They just know that it's frustrating. But that's almost always, especially in the last couple of months, been outbreaks that made that happen. So when you couldn't get that thing you wanted, it's because a bunch of people were sick. And you know, luckily, most of us don't need to go to the ER every day. But if you did in the last couple of months, you would definitely have noticed. Because one of the things I would hear is that you would just wait for hours and no one would talk to you because they were so busy taking care of everyone else who was really sick. But that's scary if you need that help. Or the number of elders in our community who have hips that need replacing that really, really hurt. And they're just walking on it. Or getting more sedentary and getting bed sores, getting things that they didn't need to get because they couldn't access that care. In this area, in the Seattle area, this got actually very close to home for me. We have a family member who was waiting on a heart procedure, couldn't get it because there was no ICU bed for them. And so that it does affect us, but we have done such a good job in the society from hiding how many people it takes to make your day work that unfortunately so many of us still aren't aware of that.
Well, thank you, Dr. Berry, for getting through that long list of questions and concerns from the community. You did a masterful job. It's 10:30. I think KPTZ probably has left us by now, maybe. And we look forward to seeing you next week and hope that our case rates go down and we continue to be turning the right tide with this. And we look forward to hearing from you regularly scheduled next week. Next Tuesday.
Well, Tuesday.
And on the Board of Health meeting. We'll see you soon.
And the Board of Health meeting, of course.